When you get a heavy rain, it's not passable anyhow because you've got to someplace you have 2 feet of water. It really becomes a flood situation. So to fix all this, you're talking about huge amounts of money and all. It's never going to get done in our time, Dick. I don't believe so. It's just one problem after another. And every so often you see some guy with a truck or a trailer, he's going to try to make it underneath the treadmill there, and bingo, he's stuck. Oh, they come along and, you know, they do all kinds of things. They'll take let the air out of the tires, try to lower it down a little bit, they'll drag it. Sometimes they just have to tear the knob on, you know, cab the trailer section of the truck apart. It becomes a real mess. This is something that there's no easy answer to any of this. I can't see anything, you know, in the future that they could possibly come up with that's going to be a reasonable, you know, repair of this situation. You got so many goddamn cross streets to deal with over here.
If a real crafty guy chose the lowest possible trailer that's made, whatever brand name it is, tried to go over under one of your underpasses by first taking the air out of the tires, on the assumption he's got some way of pumping it back up again, do you think he'd be able to lower the height enough to clear just the right place, or taking air out of the tires doesn't buy you enough? What do you think, Mel?
Remember that the clearance, I believe, is 11.6 or 11.8. I think they're all marked around that. I have never seen one more than 12 feet at either cross street. And in fact, that's the problem. The trailers all require a minimum of 12.6, 12.8. I don't think that to even let the air out, if you had a way, of course, to bring all those tires on an 18-wheeler back up again, if there would be a way to get one of them out there. It's just not going to work. There's one way to do it. Like I say, you got to get to this section of Brooklyn. You go up to Foster Avenue, which would be from where I am about 3 miles or so. Then you go up to Foster Avenue, you cross over. That's the one crossover spot of the train. That's Foster Avenue. If the train goes under Foster Avenue, only that one spot. And that's it. Now you're on that other side, and now you drive back down. In other words, you're going to go, if you were coming off, if you came from Long Island, if you came from upstate, you have to wind up, you have to wind up down here, you're coming off the Verrazano Bridge. Okay, this is a good example. You come off the Verrazano Bridge with a truck, and you want to get to this. Now, you could come straight in. The Verrazano Bridge is directly west of me, but you have to go an extra 3 miles north and then come 3 miles south if you want to come here, Dick. That would be your only path here, over.
Go. Okay, somebody else wants to join us. I'll get you in a second. At Foster Avenue, what is the clearance there? 12 foot 6 inches?
No clearance. The train goes under Foster Avenue at that one point, Dick, over.
Okay. You have a person with some comment? Give us your full call and your name, sir.
Okay. Book of your members, and most of the guys want to go to pass. You got to go on Ross Avenue, the Broken Market. It's Union Gas Company on the side to go up to the Broken Market. That's where you use the truck insurance to go every year to now.
On Ralph Avenue, would that allow a person to get to the Brighton Beach area, Darrell? What do you think?
Hopefully, yeah, the trucker's going to come from Lincoln Boulevard to Brooklyn Arts, so we're going to turn around to Ralph Avenue, from Ralph Avenue to Dismiss, and get around to the UPS used to be one time, and go to the Brooklyn Market. Over.
Sounds like you have driven vehicles like this this way a few times before. Is that true, Darrell?
Because of media deck?
Yeah. You've driven great big tractor trailer trucks along that route that you just described?
I used to live there. I used to see all the time you get stuck working and have a dweller. You can go from the, let me see, from the Rock Republic to show. You can go from the Nagasaki and Kanasi. You already can go to Rocket Hospital and come up to Rob Avenue to some booking company guests. It can come to that to go to Brooklyn Market or to anywhere you want to go, okay?
I thank you for the information. Oh, that particular route, I wonder if you've ever heard of that one before, Renville. K2KEY, K2LIW.
That's the route on the other side. I'm talking about the route if you take off, for instance, come off the Verrazano Bridge. That's to the west. He's talking to the east. Now, if you come to the west of the east, you came off the Verrazano Bridge, and you wanted to come down to Sheepshead Bay area at all, then you go out to go up to Forster Avenue. That's the only crossover. It's official for all the trucks. You come over Forster Avenue, take Forster Avenue, you can get down then to, like you said, the route there to the Brooklyn Terminal Market there. That's the Canarsie, over at Canarsie. They have that where all the produce comes in and distributed to Brooklyn. If you're coming the other way, that's the other way you're coming from the east. You can come down, you know, come to Lincoln Boulevard and all. There's another way. That's the other way. But coming from the west, get to this section. You can only cross over one place. That's Forster Avenue to take over.
Interesting. The BMT train, or the train that goes through southern areas of Brooklyn, is one of those called the New Lots Line, or the line that goes through New Lots Avenue? And if so, is that the thing that used to be called BMT? Go ahead.
The line that runs to New Lots, that's out to East New York. I don't know what they call it now. Yeah, they have the East Avenue. Have they changed all the name? I don't travel the trains anymore, so it's been quite a while since I know the train system. I mean, they're all now different. I don't know what the New Lots line is called anymore. That goes out, I believe, to East New York, which, of course, is east of me. Well, somewhat northeast of me. That's out the other direction, Dick. There's a terminal area, you know, called DeKalb Avenue. At DeKalb Avenue, a whole bunch of changeovers there. Change trains there to go to the, you know, it's a whole system. It's like a hub at DeKalb Avenue. I believe it's still a little off the spot for the trains for different sections of Brooklyn.
Yeah, back in the days when I was going to college in Brooklyn, I used to occasionally have to ride that line to pick up somebody who would drive me out east where I was living. And my goodness, the people that were on that line, wow, there were some characters. I'm sure you've seen it a few times. I don't know how many times I would see a person at the head of a train, standing in the middle of the aisle, lecturing to a mythical crowd of people that he thought was out there. And he was really lecturing to himself. I've seen that scene. I've seen a few worse things. So there are some troubled people who lived on that line, more than many other subway lines. Maybe things have changed now, but back in the early 60s, that's the way it was. You probably heard stories like this. Is that true, Mel?
Yeah, you heard. Sure, I always saw characters on the train. I went to Brooklyn Tech, you know, for 4 years. So, like, I got my share of traveling train every day, DeKalb Avenue, and yeah, you saw your share of characters, which of course, that's New York City, so, some of most of them, I can say, were harmless. Unfortunately, every so often, something happened, and there is always a possibility, you know, you got to be careful, probably, you got to be careful, basically, of, you know, standing, I always told my daughter to go on the train. She has to stand at the edge of the platform. The train doesn't come fast to people you are looking for. Stay back with your back up against one of the supports, you know, one of those steel supports. And hold on to that, you know, put your hand on that, because unfortunately we've had a number of circumstances we've heard where people get pushed onto the track that the train is coming. Mentally ill people seem to be constantly either pushing people onto the track or rather testing, you know,
things like that. So, you know, the safest thing is to stand up against one of Ryan's stanchions and kick over.
Yeah, I call them H columns. H beam or H columns. And you're absolutely right. Don't stand so close to the edge. I've seen people do it. Talk to anybody who works in the subway system. And there's a significant training course you have to go through in order to be able to do work on the tracks. A lot of safety procedures have to be followed. And there are times when you're working in a tunnel, you hear almost nothing, and all of a sudden the train is there. If you're not in the right place at the right time, life gets pretty complicated pretty fast. Your chances of survival are not good. I think a couple of people were lost in about a one-week period of time this summer in the subway system. And I'll bet you there was a significant investigation as to how that happened and what safety measures were being bypassed to allow those workmen to be in that spot at that time and therefore perish because of it. New York City is something else. There are people who think it's the greatest place in the world, particularly if you love tennis. I know some people who have decided when they came from a foreign country, they wanted to live in New York City just to make sure they could see what goes on at the Tennis Open. They love that game so much. And certainly a lot of attractions when it comes to museums. I don't know if you've ever been to what used to be the Hayden Planetarium and is now called the Rose Center Planetarium. Very nice display by my standards. If you have the slightest interest in astronomy, awfully well done. When you see the comparison of the size of the planet and that rather large scale model they've got, it gives you an impression that's very different than what you get when you read a book. When you walk down that spiral staircase, as I call it, and they have you walk back in time as to what the universe was like, also gives you some very good information. The show is very good. And while you're there, you can also visit the Museum of Natural History. Everybody wants to see those dinosaurs. Kind of hard to believe that animals that big once lived and walked on this planet. I think the word dinosaur translates into the word thunder lizard. When one of those guys came running by, I bet you there was a bit of rumbling in the sound. I'm also of the belief that an animal that big would have to move very slowly. As things get smaller, by comparison to size, they can move faster and faster. This all became very obvious to me when I was writing an article 2 weeks ago for the Microwave Reflector. A man was complaining about the fact that he wants to do miniature work on electronics, and his eyesight is failing, and therefore he was saying he could no longer do it. And I wrote an article very strongly suggesting to him that he's creating a self-fulfilling prophecy. Every human repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel. Every human being, as you grow older, usually becomes a little bit more nearsighted, quite often becomes a little bit you develop some astigmatism. Quite often you develop presbyopia. That's a fancy way of saying that the lens of your eye is no longer as flexible as it used to be. Therefore, your range of focus becomes drastically decreased. The amount of adaptation you can have to focus decreases. So, therefore, your ability to focus on small parts up close, surface mount components on a printed circuit board, you think disappears. I strongly disagree with that. You buy the right visualizing equipment. If you have any eyesight left at all, you will see. 10 years ago, I bought a Bausch & Lomb stereo zoom microscope. I was at Utica, working at the Rome Air Development Center, walking to that main surplus house in Utica, and there was this beautiful microscope. I would have been happy to pay the guy $350 for it. He wanted $150. I did not try to talk him to a lower price. I opened my wallet, handed him the money, made sure that I had the thing in my hand before he changed his mind. You take a stereo zoom Bausch & Lomb microscope, which zooms from 8 to 35 in magnification, and I use it at 8, 95% of the time. With the right kind of lighting equipment, you get a three-dimensional color picture. And when you look at small objects, you wouldn't believe what you're going to see. You just look at your finger. You look at the nail on your finger and your fingerprint. and the material that's under your nail that you've never seen before. Well, you remove a splinter from your finger and you do it under a microscope. What a difference. When you're working on micro-miniature parts, let me drop. You notice that the miniature world behaves extremely differently compared to what I would call the full-size world. You need a whole lot of very small tweezers, needle-nose pliers, little bitty wooden sticks, sticky substances, Sacto knife. You need a whole lot of very special tools to work on surface-mount components. And when you're working on those surface-mount components under a microscope, the world is so different. You'll notice that every force you apply with your hands and fingers, every force you apply is too big. You can't make the force small enough. And nothing at that size slides smoothly. You try to position a surface-mount resistor on the printed circuit board. That's a little bit off to the left side. And you reach in there with a sharp object and you try to push it to the right. And you assume it's going to slide to the right. You apply a little bit of force. At first nothing happens. And all of a sudden the darn thing jumps. And it moves. You want it to move a 1/32 of an inch and it moves 2 inches. It jumps out of the way. You say, what in the world is going on? Or if you succeed in moving a small enough deflection, and you think you're going to move the thing a 1/64 of an inch to the right, it jumps upside down. And you've got to go through a lot of rigmarole to get it right side up again and in the right position. It takes a lot of very special skill to move components around micro-miniature. Most of the components I'm soldering these days, professionally, are called 0402. That means 40,000 long, 20,000 wide. The numbers would lead you to believe that's a good sized component. You look at a plastic bag full of 0402 resistors, and it looks like grains of sand. And they come half that size. They come 0201. But you can't even see them when you get a bag full of them. It looks like it's grains of sand that you've ground up in a mortar and pestle, you know what I mean. You ground them up into a small size. They're almost like powder. And so when it comes to micro-miniature waveguide circuits, when it comes to high-frequency circuits these days, a hell of a lot of the inductance and straight capacitance disappears if you make the circuit small enough. Let me drop one more time. But it takes a very special skill, learning curve, I'm going to call it, in order to use these micro-miniature components. Whatever you're trying to solder down, there's got to be a third hand holding it down, a third implement holding it down. You've got the solder in your left hand, you have the soldering hand in your right hand, there better be a third thing holding it down. Because at that size level, simple capillary action looks like it's going to lift up the Empire State Building. Your little component that you just soldered down, it says, yeah, that's nice, the solder flowed. You pull away the soldering iron, and the component is on the soldering iron. It doesn't want to stay on the board. It wants to follow the soldering iron. Because the capillary action between the solder, the component, and the iron sucks it up. So there's got to be something to hold it down. That's just one of many problems, many learning curves. There's a hell of a lot of time at the lowest magnification. You want to find your tool under the microscope, and you can't find it. You have to put your eye out over the side and look where the tool is, look where the part is, and say, oh, there's where I got to move. And then you get it in the right position. Then you look back through the microscope. Oh, yeah, there's my tool. But it meant you can't find your old tool. You talk to a guy who's about to buy a microscope, just like a guy who's about to buy a telescope. It's very easy to fall into the trap. More gain is better. You buy a 2-inch diameter telescope, refractor type telescope, and the advertisement will say 150 power. You buy that thing, you're in trouble. Anything more than 60 power times the number of inches of the forward aperture is crazy. It just gives you a fuzzy picture. You'd rather use a telescope at magnification 60, not 150. You can easily buy a microscope that starts off at 30 and goes up to 100. You can't use it. When you got an 8 to 35, you're going to spend 95% of your time at magnification 8. That doesn't sound like much magnification. When you're looking at a well-lit, forward-lit stereo, three-dimensional picture in full color of the world with 8 times magnification, it's a very different world. And that's where you're going to be if you work on modern circuits. And as long as you've got any eyesight at all, you use the right visualizing equipment, you'll see what you're going to see. And even if you've got myopia like crazy and astigmatism like crazy. You just add the right kind of corrective lens to the eyepiece of the microscope. If you can read a newspaper, even a one with extremely large print, you can do microscope work. And even if you think your hands are too shaky, the people who do that kind of work find ways of bracing their hand against solid objects, the table, a post, or some other, a square solid object that they put near their hand. They find ways of bracing their hand so that the shake of the hand is not that much of a detriment. And you learn how to move parts and accept the fact they're not going to slide.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Accept the fact that nothing will fly. It moves and jumps. The microminiature world is something else. K2KEY, K2RAW.
All right, this is K2KEY. Well, I got that magnifier that I have on the bench with the fluorescent light and, around me. And that's it. I can't do whatever I want to do with that. That's it, Dick. I'm not getting into the micro stuff at all. Too much time for us. We're dinosaurs. Talk about dinosaurs. My daughter was the dinosaurs. That's it.
That's true. This is a new world for the younger people and all.
Maybe not supposed to be doing so. I just don't. Not in my line of work anymore. To tell you the truth, I fool around with these things here and there. But I see sometimes I'm on a walkie-talkie. I prepared this one walkie-talkie where I had to replace one of those circuit tech old stuff. And I just need, you need a third hand. You need a hand to hold the solder, not a hand to hold the solder, and a third hand to hold the damn thing in place. it's a situation that, it's like almost, you gotta have some kind of device to hold them down and all. I think it's time to let this be something for younger people that, let's put it this way. I think I should have stopped when we did away with the Weller 250 iron.
I used my Weller 250 soldering gun today to solder things down. Have you ever at the salt mine or any other place you visited ever used a well-lit stereo zoom microscope? And if you do, you'll get a beautiful picture. It's very hard to say, boy, that looks nice. I gotta have one of those. I've used a great big magnifying glass with a ring light around it. I think it gives you a magnification of about 3 or 4. It's good. A good stereo zoom microscope is a lot better, Mel. For you to say, I'm getting too old, my eyes are not good enough, my hands are not steady enough, that I can't do that work, that's your decision if you want to believe that. I think you're making a decision that could be a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you wanted to have the ability to repair modern-day handy-talkies, and I think you do, the next time I visit you, the next time you and I are face-to-face, I'm going to bring my microscope, and I'm going to bring nothing more than a $100 bill and let you look at it. You look at the speckled version of a modern-day $100 bill under a microscope, and you'll say, wow, how in the world did they do that? And I now know why. The best Xerox machine ain't never going to reproduce that thing. I don't care if it's the highest resolution Xerox machine in the world. It can't reproduce that portion of a $100 bill. Just for instance. So have you ever looked through a really good microscope? And what made you say, I don't have to have one of those? I'm a little bit curious about that one, Mel. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've looked through a number of microscopes and seen, I was even once privy to actually see an electron microscope used in a facility in New York City. So I've seen really quality, microscopes reproducing some phenomenal pictures, even ones that had a camera attachment. And you could also do it on a screen nearby for teaching purposes. They have these cameras built into these fancy microscopes. So, and I can say you can look at some phenomenal things. I mean, fast-paced, you can put things under.
Well,
you know, I do. Yes, I do when I move around sometimes, you know, more magnification. You know, in other words, I'm not doing it for a daily living. I'm not depressed. I have a Bosch & Lomb eyepiece, a jeweler's eyepiece. I think it's, what, 8 times or whatever. You know, it's a very good eyepiece. It's made for the jewelry industry. And I snap it into my eye, you know, I put it on there, and with a good light and everything like that, it usually suffices when I'm doing a takeover.
Each of those things are good. The thing that you wear as a hat, which has got 2 magnifying lenses in it, is kind of good. The great big round lens you use with the circular light, that's quite good. The thing that you clip over your glasses, the Bosch & Lomb thing you described, that's good. But if you ever look through a microscope where both eyes go through 2 eyepieces and you get a well-lit, stereo, 3-dimensional picture with a zoom-type control on the side, have you ever used one of those, Mel?
I've seen them. Yeah, I've looked at them. They showed me some looking at. They ground off one place. They took an integrated circuit, and they were looking to see some kind of failure due to some kind of burn or something in the integrated circuit. And you know how they did analysis on it? They actually grind it down by layer. They have some kind of precision grinding process, and then they actually look at it under a microscope. And I was standing there, and they let me look at it. Like fascinating to actually look into an IC. I don't know if you've ever, you know, tried that thing. And definitely, you know, the difference is like you say, with a, you know, looking at a stereo microscope, basically like taking a pair of binoculars, looking with a pair of binoculars versus a monocular, a mononocular type of, you know, or looking through one of the, your binoculars, looking through one of the lenses versus the 2 of them, over.
Oh, yeah. I own an 8-inch diameter Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope. And a year or so ago, I bought a binaural lens or a stereo eyepiece for it. In other words, instead of my eyes just with one eye looking through the eyepiece, both eyes looking through the eyepiece. And at first you would say, gee, I'm going to divide the light by 2. Each eye is going to see half the light. It's going to be a dimmer picture. That's what I expected the answer to be. When both eyes are gathering the information, you get a lot more information. You see dimmer stars. You see with higher resolution. It's just a lot more fun. You've got to use both eyes. Man's got binaural vision. You've got to use it. Another tool I've been using recently now, a real fun tool, thermal imaging camera. And they're getting better and better. I'd like to say they're getting cheaper and cheaper. Well, they used to be infinite price, now they're just very expensive. It's about the same price as an inexpensive network analyzer, you know, a professional grade or a spectrum analyzer. But a thermal imaging camera is a lot of fun, because when you build antennas in every nook and cranny of a chunk of electronics, and I've been doing some of that work professionally lately, the problem you run into is that you first have to realize you cannot design an antenna that is lossless. In other words, it doesn't have any carbon granules in there, doesn't have any resistors in there, doesn't have any lossy plastics and dummy loads anywhere. If the antenna is made out of conductors and insulators, the antenna has to run at 100% efficiency. That means you put 1 watt into the antenna, 0.99 watts has to be radiated somewhere into space. That's rule number one. Rule number two, if you cannot design an antenna where the peak gain is less than isotropic. So a lossless antenna must have a gain of at least isotropic, 0 dBi as they call it. Let me drop. The next thing you realize is that, okay, I've got this very compact package with a whole lot of jazz in there. Integrated circuits and surface mount resistors and surface mount capacitors and hybrids and inductors and turns and transmitting sections and a frequency synthesizer section and a liquid crystal display section. It's got all this jazz packed with all kinds of stuff. And you build an antenna in that environment. And you go and test the gain of the antenna, and you find out it's 5 dB below isotropic. And you say, wait a minute, you can't do that. I built it out of good conductors, gold-plated conductor, just to give you an example, and I measured the gain of the antenna, and it's 5 dB below isotropic. You can't do that. There's 5 dB of loss somewhere. The only way you can have loss at radio frequencies is somebody's eating your lunch. By that I mean something is sucking up the RF energy and converting it into heat. There is no other way to dissipate RF energy. You either radiate it into space. If you did, the antenna's got gain. And if it didn't radiate into space, then somebody is eating it up, turning it into heat. And say, we say to ourselves, me and this very group of guys I work with, we say, aha, I got to get a thermal imaging camera. Who's eating my lunch? And you put a watt of power through the antenna, you aim the thermal camera at it, and see who gets hot. I expected to have to put a watt of power through the antenna and wait 5 minutes for something to get hot. With a modern-day thermal imaging camera, you put 50 milliwatts of power into the antenna, aim the thermal imaging camera at it, and 5 seconds later, you watch this thing pop out at you and starts getting brighter and brighter. That's the way the thermal imaging camera works. It changes color as a function of brightness. That's got a scale one side saying the hottest thing in that picture is 98 degrees Fahrenheit. And the crosshairs you put over that component, well, that component you're looking at is 85 degrees Fahrenheit. It's a lot of fun. I gotta have one of them. I wish it wasn't so damn expensive. But if you're designing miniature antennas in a tough environment, and you want to find out who's eating your lunch, wow, that's a fun tool. K2KUY, K2LIW.
And it's funny, you talk about thermal cameras. I know a guy that he works for a company, and they basically, do surveys on houses to determine the point where it needs insulation, further insulating. And he broke the cable connector off with the other unit, power supply, whatever it was. I mean, it's just a few wires in there. And I took the connector apart, soldered it up for him. So while he was here, he showed me, he aimed it at the wall, we fooled with it in the house. As a thank you for me, doing the repair. And great, I took it upstairs and looked at the ceiling. And sure enough, it showed these spots where the house needed further insulating. And I said, gee, like with studs come up and things like that, places that I would never think of insulating, against the outside, the cold elements outside. And it was amazing. You should see this thing, Dick, in the camera. It's got a viewer and everything like that, and it's for thermal imaging of homes, over.
Yeah, if I get a chance, I'm going to borrow this instrument and do exactly that. It's got a liquid crystal display, multicolor, and so color is used as a method of displaying what's hot and what's cold. And there are versions of these thermal imaging cameras where it'll take two pictures side by side. One picture with a normal camera in black and white, one picture with a thermal imaging camera with multiple colors, and you can either set it up side by side or one image superimposed on the other. With the normal black and white optical camera, you recognize images right away. You recognize objects right away. And with the thermal imaging camera, it shows you which portion of those objects are hot. With a very sensitive modern-day thermal imaging camera, you look at a human being's face. Wow. That's something else. Particularly if the guy's wearing glasses. The glasses look dark as all hell. His face looks hot as all hell. The nose is the hottest part, the chin is the next hottest part, the ears are the next hottest part, various other portions are cold. Really something. You can take the best looking guy in the lab, you aim that camera at him, and you think you're looking at stock that's been painted. K2KEY, K2RIW.
You say something very strange, but it's true. The person has this imaging camera. They were fooling around like that with it, and one of the people they aimed it at showed up something on his leg that was like a hot spot or something on his leg. And they finally coerced him into going to a doctor, and sure enough, there was some kind of cancerous growth, believe it or not, that showed up at the hottest spot. On his leg, and just by
fool with the camera stick, over.
You're going to be hearing more and more about that in the future, Mel. A year ago, I worked on a project that didn't quite go to completion, which had to go to completion, it would have been the electronics for a camera that can resolve better than a thousandth of a degree centigrade difference, maybe even a thousandth of a degree Fahrenheit. But when you can look at that fine a thermal resolution in temperature difference, you will be able to find cancers. Because a cancer, by definition, is a bunch of cells that are dividing too fast. To divide too fast, they need more energy. To use more energy, they got a richer blood supply. So for a whole bunch of reasons, cancers are much more thermal, exothermic, than is normal flesh tissue, normal human tissue. So if you've got a thermal imaging camera that has enough angular resolution and enough small temperature degree resolution, and you aim it at various organs on the outside skin of a human being, I suspect you would be able to find cancers that might even be an inch below the skin, like a human chest, for instance. I think you would see it as a raised temperature area. And as a non-invasive diagnostic technique, that's got a lot of capability. And so better and better focal plane arrays of thermal imaging, microbolometer type things are being invented these days with more and more sensitivity. They no longer require cryogenic cooling like they used to. In the early days, a good thermal imaging camera, you had to pour liquid nitrogen to it, and that's a pain in the neck. That's a lot of rigmarole, a lot of trouble, extra cost, extra time. You got to wait for it to cool down. You can't cool it down too many times before it breaks. And after you cool it down, eventually the dewar of liquid nitrogen runs out just at the critical time you're making a measurement, and the thing comes back up to room temperature, and it doesn't show you anything anymore. Well, the modern-day thermal imaging cameras have bypassed 95% of all those problems. They give you a beautiful image. So, as a diagnostic tool in human beings, I guarantee you're going to start hearing a lot more about that in the future, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Oh yeah, Roger. Dick, how about the dog that they said sniff out a person having a some kind of a cancer condition of some sort? Do you believe that they actually have dogs that are trained to detect cancer, over?
No doubt in my mind, Mel. I believe it. The smelling system on a dog, I don't know if the number is 10 times or 100 times more sensitive than a human being. On top of that, the smelling system of a dog has a whole lot of colors to it, so to speak. I mean, you and I can smell a sweet flour, sourdough. We can smell a range of about four or five kinds of smells. And that beautiful olfactory system of a canine. My goodness. I mean, he can smell the dirt that a dog friend of his has walked on 2 days ago, and if it didn't rain, he knows which one of his friends walked on that dirt because of the smell that's left. And he can tell dog A from dog B from dog C from dog D because they all have a slightly different smell. So a dog smell system is tremendously more sensitive, and it's got a lot more colors to it, so to speak. And specific diseases on a human being tend to give off a certain characteristic smell that a trained dog can recognize. Now, this is not going to be a 100% effective diagnostic tool. I think it's only going to be 80% effective. But if it can find a good number of misdetected diseases by smell, and it gives you some hint as to which diagnostic procedures you should use, and save you money on the other ones that are too expensive, that are not appropriate for that particular medical condition, I think the dog can help a lot. Oh, I see a lot of faith in that. You watch that program called Scientific American Frontiers, where various people, when they drop, are trying to invent instrumentation that can come close to the sensitivity and color range of smells of a canine. You try to invent a machine that can do that. It is difficult. I think they're going to make progress. Someday they're going to get there. Right now, the dog is way ahead of them, in my opinion. You've seen dogs sniff out explosives and drugs and whatever, a couple of molecules of an aerosol, that dog can pick up and tell you what it is and what direction it came from. The antenna mechanism that's on a morph, listening, trying to strain the air, looking for that pheromone of a female at the right time of the year. It only takes in a couple of molecules that you would have great difficulty seeing under an electron microscope, and you can find them. Birds chirp, make sounds, because with direction-finding equipment, they can find each other. Can you imagine two bugs in a tree trying to find each other without that direction-finding equipment and without emitting the smell or that sign or that sound? It's worse than a needle in a haystack. But if the one bug that wants to find the other one is emitting a smell or a sound, life gets out a lot easier. I found this out the hard way by buying and using for a short period of time something called key ringer. It's these two little devices that you put on your car keys. And so you put one on your belt and one on your car keys. And so you lose your car keys, you lose your glasses, you lose the remote control for the television set or the VCR, and if it's got one of these key ringers on it with a little bit of a battery and a sounding device, if you're within 300 feet of the device and you press the find me button on the other one, it emits an ultrasonic sound with a particular code to it, and the little bitty microphone on the other device picks up that sound and it starts beeping, squawking, and lighting its light, saying, here I am. You can bury those keys or that remote control under a pillow, behind the couch, in the other room. And you press the find me button, and it hears that sound because the ultrasonic sound pierces the wall, pierces the pillow, it finds it, and the thing starts squawking. And you start going toward that squawking sound into that flashing light, and you found that missing item. You use one of these things, and you'll say, wow, that's a fun toy. And it costs $29 for a pair of them. Key ringer. Go to your website, go to your Google and search the word key ringer. KEY-RINGER, I think it is. And for $29, you'll be amazed how much fun you'll have with that toy. It's not a toy. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger. Sounds like
that.
Oh, yeah, they have, of course, you know, you have arms go on. Also, you put down the cordless phone. You have a button push to locate it. You push the button, makes it seem. So, yeah, they got all these good little gadgets out. A ton of these little toys out that you can have a lot of fun with. All right, I don't know of anything else really. Emails here, but I guess maybe late thought on them. But I want to real quickly go over.
Choose one of your pieces of mail, Bill. Go ahead.
I was reading through a few of them, and not to get into detail on one, a whole conversation here of people with we thought it would open Pandora's box up last week. We thought it was discussing quads versus Yagi. So I'm going to let that go because we'll be here. Well, I know the receipt is going to go out, but we'll be here for quite a while, you know, with that controversy all over again, the quad and Yagi thing that's been going on indefinitely. So I'm not even going to touch that tonight. But here's one that's interesting, real quickie. Our club just got a new generator, and I was reading over it because this basically is operation, and they said if you want to know more about the operation of a generator, you should look into understanding the left-hand rule. Let's see, what is it? Left-hand rule. What is Steve Elliott? Briefly, can you tell me what the left-hand rule is? I don't know, you want to take that or should I say a few words? All right, you do it first, pick over.
Yeah, there's a so-called right-hand rule and the left-hand rule. I think the right-hand rule is the one where you are the creator of the magnetic field. By using your middle finger, index finger, and thumb, and set it up in such a way that the thumb is straight in the air, the index finger is straight out, and the middle finger is at right angles to the index finger. Almost as if you're making the shooting of a gun symbol with your hand, so to speak. And so those three things at right angles represent the direction of current flow, the direction of motion, and the direction of the magnetic field. They represent the relationship between the two. And right-hand rule is if you're generating the magnetic field by you generating the current. And I think the left-hand rule is the one you use when you are the generator instead of when you're not making the magnetic field, but you're using the magnetic field to convert it back into electrical energy. I think it's the left-hand rule. But the three fingers represent the directions of current, motion, and magnetic field. And they give you the relationship and allow you to figure out which direction the current's going to flow for what motion. So if you're waving a wire near a magnetic field, or a coil of wire near a magnetic field, and you want to know what direction is the current going to flow and how much, the right-hand rule and left-hand rule will help you. I think most college students are taught those rules, and I may have it backwards, but correct me on this one now. K2KEY, KQLIW.
Yeah, I was right there, basically. Okay. Basically, what Dick is saying, for instance, where as far as this one is concerned, the talk about the left hand rule would generate them. I think you can stay with that because time's up here. But basically, what Dick is saying, if you take your thumb and you take your forefinger and you form it into a right angle, in other words, like you would be making it, like you could make a gun simple, you know. Then if you take your middle finger and you hold it at right angles to that, the thumb is motion of the conductor. So it's in a motion of the conductor. The forefinger will be the direction of the flux, such as from north to south. And the middle finger, going at right angles to it, will give you the direction of the current direction. That's basically what the left-hand rule is. It is what it uses to determine the direction of current or voltage induced by what we call a conductor. I think that's the simplest way I can put it. Over.
Yes, and that rule will allow you to figure out when you hold your magnetic compass near a piece of wire that's hooked up to a dry cell or to a flashlight battery and current is flowing through it. It allows you to figure out which direction will the compass indicate. If you have a bar magnet and you've got a coil of wire and you shove the bar magnet down the coil of wire and then pull it back out, that rule will let you figure out which direction the current is going to flow into that solenoid of current of a coil of wire, solenoid shaped coil of wire. It's a handy rule. But magnetic field, motion, and current induced are all at right angles to each other. A similar phenomenon occurs with a gyroscope. If you had an ideal gyroscope, and if it's set up with the axis perpendicular to the table, that means the wheel of the gyroscope is parallel to the table, and in top view, the gyroscope is spinning clockwise, and you push on the top of the gyroscope so that the top is trying to tilt away from you while the bottom is being held by the table, so to speak. The gyroscope will push back on you, but it will do something else. It will deflect to the right. A gyroscope always moves at right angles to the direction you push on it. There's a very similar set of rules for it. And some of the rules by which a gyroscope works are kind of amazing. If you have a satellite system that has NASA Select, and from time to time, the astronauts, when they've got some free time, when they drop, and they're in orbit in weightlessness on the space shuttle, and they experiment with something like a gyroscope, and they start connecting two gyroscopes or three gyroscopes together in various combinations, it's kind of amazing the way it behaves. Some of it is opposite of common sense if you go one or two levels deeper into the study of what's going on. But there's a number of things in the world that work in an orthogonal manner. Magnetic field is one of them. Gyroscope action is another. The way a Hall effect device is another. There's a lot of things that work orthogonally at right angles. KQKEY, KQLAW.
Sir, very right. This is KQKEY. Very fascinating. The generating of electric is a fascinating field in itself. And as Dick was just saying about, you know, the different situations, how you want to go step by step in the generating of an EMF, you know, how it goes, basically what you're looking at. And I'll just elaborate a little bit on after the next question would be on the after the left hand rule. Actually what happens in generating is going through a loop makes one revolution, 360 degrees. So the induced voltage by this method passes actually from zero to a positive maximum, to zero to a negative maximum, and then back to zero again. So then, if the generator is the speed of the rotation is constant, the output voltage could be a sine wave. That's basically what is taking place on one 360-degree rotation of the generator. So you can actually look at it. So if you go from 0, 90 degrees, and go back to 0 at 180, go to minus at 270, and then back to 0 at 360. That's basically one rotation of a generator that would give you what we call sine wave. I guess that's the simplest way I can put it. This over.
That's a very good way of putting it. So an old-fashioned generator, which used to have a steady-state magnetic coil on the outside, fed by the battery. So the battery had current flowing through a coil of wire on the outside, making a magnetic field. And the armature had a number of windings that went to the commutator. Each individual winding is making a sine wave, positive and negative voltage. But the way the wave on each individual winding connects to the commutator is such that the commutator becomes a synchronous detector. And you set up the two brushes on the commutator so that they always touch each one of the individual coils by way of the individual strips of the commutator at the instant of time that the voltage is positive. And therefore, the old-fashioned generator would pick up positive voltage on one brush and negative voltage on the other brush as it turned. Worked reasonably well, but there's a problem. You wanted that generator on a modern-day car to generate at least 60 amperes. On a really stoochy car, you want it to generate 100 or 120 amperes. You put 100 amperes to a set of carbon brushes that are continuously sliding across those copper strips of a commutator, and I don't have to tell you, you're going to be making a lot of carbon dust, a lot of sparking and arcing, a lot of electromagnetic interference, and you're wearing down those brushes pretty fast. The old-fashioned generators of automobiles, you had to replace those brushes every couple of years because they wore down. The modern-day alternator does everything backwards. Let me drop. Instead of making the magnetic field on the outside and the rotating coil on the inside, they got it backwards. They make the magnetic field on the inside on the armature. That's what rotates. The magnetic field rotates, and the coils that pick it up now sit steady and are on the outside. And they don't put one set of coils, they put three sets of coils displaced 120 degrees apart. So you've got three-phase sine waves coming out of all the wires of the scatter. The outer part that doesn't move is called the scatter. The inner part is the rotator, is the armature. So by way of the wires on the outside having the high current output and no brushes, all they have to do now is go through a full-wave diode bridge rectifier assembly. And for each sweeping of the wires through that local magnetic field, as the magnetic field is sweeps through the wires, because the magnetic field is now the armature, you get six pulses per sweeping of the magnetic field. On top of that, they've arranged the armature in such a way that isn't just one north and south. It's got, I'm not sure of the exact number, I'm going to guess 12 north and 12 south in the way the winding is made in the armature. And to make the magnetic field of the armature only requires a couple of amperes, not 60 amperes. You just make it a fine enough wire, enough turns, and you get enough magnetic field with a couple of amperes through slip rings. So now very little current has to flow through those brushes. They last for almost the life of the car. An alternator is a lot more efficient, does a much better job. That little whine you hear in the background when you hear somebody on a two-meter mobile rig clearing at about a 600 kc, a 600 cycle note. That's how fast the three-phase rectifier is working on those data coils. About a 600 hertz note, maybe it even gets up to 1 kc when you're raising the engine. And that's a nice, fast rectifier system. Gives you a pretty smooth voltage to charge the battery, run the light, and run your mobile rig in the car. So alternators now are much more compact, much more efficient, much more long-lasting, do a much better job, require a lot lower RPM. There are alternators these days at idling speed of the car. They'll give you about half the maximum current output. If you've got a 60-ampere alternator, you may be able to get 20 or 30 amperes out of the thing at idling speed. That's a darn nice device. K2KUY, K2RIW.
Hey, very good. Yeah, that's right. I was just generated. And I won't get into it any further tonight. I haven't got the time. But we should pick up a bit more questions on it next week. How a generator. We never really touched on basically on how generators work. Basically, generators, how it works. So I don't know if anybody listening didn't want to continue to say so. I guess with that, we'll say goodnight and thank everybody that's joined us. We do celebrate the Jewish holiday coming up this week. Have a great holiday, and thank you also for joining us every week here. This is KQY. Back to the for this final.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what's the exact day of Rosh Hashanah, but I think the High Holy Days are coming up, and does that mean you will or will not be available next Sunday? Then we'll go ahead.
Thursday and Friday, over.
Okay, sounds like you will be available. Okay, you guys have just listened to TechNet number 1153 of the series that began in September of 1982. 25 years ago, maybe today, I'm not sure. This could be the week of our 25th anniversary of the TechNet. And so, you probably heard the fireworks going off in the background. And particularly over there on, I'm trying to remember, what's the location that I was listening to the other day? Yeah, somewhere over there on Dover Street is where there was some fireworks. Because of the 25th anniversary, 73-year-old. Well, Mel and I will most likely be back next week with four of these long tails, and we'll see you down the line. KQRIW, TechNet Landmark, we're clear.